Good afternoon, everybody. I'd like to go ahead and call the Senate Finance Committee to order Thursday, the 12th of March, 2026. With me today is Chairs Hoffman and Olson. Senator Keel, Senator Merrick, Senator Kaufman, Senator Cronk, myself, Stedman. We got two items on the agenda today. We're going to start with a new piece of legislation, Senate Bill 274, Permanent Fund, the POMV available for appropriations, and then we will continue on with House Bill 78, which is Retirement Systems Defined Benefit Option, and there will be a presentation by Legislative Finance on that particular piece of legislation, and we'll set it aside for now. And we'll like to go ahead and start. Senate Bill 274, Permanent Fund, the percent of market value available for appropriation. This is the first hearing on this bill. To introduce the bill, Mr. David Scott, staff to myself, Senator Stedman, and he will go ahead and introduce himself for the record, who he represents, and then he'll introduce the bill, and we'll go from there.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, I'm David Scott. I'm staff to Senator Stedman and staff to the Senate Finance Committee. The bill in front of the committee today is SB 274. The title is an act relating to the computation of the amount available for appropriation from the Alaska Permanent Fund. On page two here, this is the purpose and intent explaining that, Mr. Chairman. The purpose is to lower the draw rate of the permanent fund to strengthen the long-term growth of the fund. And the intent is to maintain generational equity by preserving the purchasing power of the Alaska Permanent Fund against inflation. Another way of saying that, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, is that distributions from the permanent fund should not deplete the purchasing power of the fund for future generations. Before I get into the nuts and bolts of the bill, Mr. Chairman, I thought we'd have just a brief primer on the POMV. POMV stands for percent of market value, and it's a rules-based, it's a fiscal framework where we limit the annual draw to a percentage of the five-year average of the market value of the fund. In 2018, SB 26, which is a bill that started in this committee, we transitioned to the POMV model. Prior to that, calculations for distributions from the fund were an average of the earnings of the fund, in contrast, POMV is the calculations are based on the total value of the fund. We had found that over time, the total value of the fund, the market value of the fund, an average is a lot more stable and less volatile as the earnings of the fund. And because of the stability there, we now have a predictable, structured, and sustainable draw from the fund. So here he is. What does SB 274 do? It's a simple to understand bill. It doesn't mean it's an easy bill, but it's a simple to understand bill in that we lower the POMV draw rate from 5% to 4.5% by a step down of 0.1% per year. That begins in FY29. As you can see on FY29, the draw rate would be 4.9% of the five-year average of the fund, and FY30, 4.8, and so on down to FY33. A quick section analysis of the fund, of the bill, Mr. Chairman. Section 1 lowers the rate over a five-year period from 5% to 4.5%. Section 2 would set the draw rate at 4.5%. Section 3 is a conforming section. It is the Amaretta Hess carve-out. That's in law now. It's a conforming section of this bill. Section 4 is the effective date for Section 2. Again, Section 2 is where the draw rate is set at 4.5, and that begins in July 1, 2032. That is the FY33 date. Section 5 delays as a delayed effective date of July 1, 2028. Mr. Chairman, the delayed effective date is to allow the next legislature that takes its seat in next January to have one budget year under the 5% draw rate before they begin the step down to 4.9. so that the next legislature doesn't come in right away and have a 4.9% draw. They have a be able to transition. And this slide, Mr. Chairman, is to just a little look back on the when the POMV started. The draw started in FY19. You see the first 3 years were at 5.25 draw. That was in SB 26, and then we stepped down to a 5% draw, and we've been there since. This bill, if it's enacted, you can see that the draw rate would begin to step down in FY 29. We also added another column to the right there, the effective draw rate. So the effective draw rate, Mr. Chairman, is the it's the POMV draw percentage against the previous year's the previous fiscal year's market value of the fund. So the draw rate might have been, well, the draw rate was, say, 5%. But that calculation of that number is against the previous year's market value of the fund. So that's why the effective draw rate will be a little bit lower. This would be the only modeling you'll see in this presentation, not even if it's modeling. And to let the chairman know, the public, and the committee members know that there's future modeling coming from the Legislative Finance Division and Callan. Callan is the they work with the permanent fund. They've been in front of you several times before. With that, Mr. Is there any questions?
So just for those watching at home, we've had a when we had our update from the permanent fund here a few weeks ago, Callan was before the committee talking about the permanent fund, and part of the presentation and discussion with that was the draw rate and the forward expectation of the financial markets and the returns, also inflation, and the concern being that the 5% draw rate was at the extreme top for the well-being of the fund. And that if it was a lower draw rate, the ability to sustain the payout and that and those funds on the payout go to core services of the state along with the dividend payment stabilizes it. And as mentioned here a few minutes ago, the modeling will be in front of the committee at the next time we bring it up from Legislative Finance and a presentation from Callan. We thought it would be beneficial to get the subject on the table so the public is aware that this discussion is going to come forward, even though I see nobody on the public testimony list today, and somebody might show up here in a minute or two. But I would expect that the committee would be having additional public hearing on the subject after the modeling and the Callan discussion before we look to the committee members to take action. But it's such a significant issue that affects all the citizens in Alaska and future generations. We want to make sure the public has ample opportunity to enter the discussion. Senator Kaufman.
Yes, sir. Thank you. I guess one of the things immediately I wonder about if it goes far enough of, pulling down to a 4.5, we get the benefit in an ascending market climate where the effective rate is pulled back because of the ascent of the market value. So that trailing action in the five-year trailing average helps lever the effective rate down. If we get into the opposite type of market conditions, it pulls the other direction. And I think it would be interesting in the modeling to see what we need to get to where we're in an even safer territory in a descending market climate with that net effect of the effective drawdown if we're in a declining market. Mm-hmm. Maybe just go a little deeper into that end of it. Just to see.
We could express that to Callan. I think they touched on that when they presented in front of us a few weeks ago. But we all have that restated. They had several market cycles that they looked at when they were talking about the draw rate. So we'll have that repeated, and if we need more detail, we'll get it. Other questions before I go to public hearing? From give me a minute, I'll go ahead and open the public hearing, at least the first one. I'm hoping that we'll have one more after this. I see nobody that's called in on the off-net. Is there anybody in the audience that want to come forward? Seeing no enthusiasm to come forward from the audience today, and we'll ask them again after we have the modeling up and the dollar amounts up. And I'd like to just note that this does decrease the amount of funds coming out annually, the permanent fund, but one of the advantages of a delay and a slow escalation down, it gives the portfolio time to escalate in value. So we'll be looking at those two issues. So I'll go ahead and close the public hearing. Let's go to the fiscal notes. Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senate Bill 274 has one fiscal note from the Department of Revenue, Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation. Their operations section shows that it would not increase costs. They give it a zero cost. On the change in revenues, they showed beginning in fiscal year 2029 a decrease of flow to the general fund of million dollars per year, gradually increasing to 378 in fiscal year 2032.
And I think what we'll do is we'll ask Callan to chart this table so we can have it on the screen for the public to see at the next meeting when we bring it up. I think that'd be beneficial. Any other comments, concerns, or questions before we set this bill aside? Seeing none, we'll go ahead and set this bill aside for further review at a later date.
We need to verify that because this is.
We're now going to move on to the next item on the agenda.
That's not right.
We have House Bill 78, Retirement Systems, Defined Benefit Option. We'd like to have the Director of Legislative Finance, Mr. Lexi Painter, come forward to the table, introduce himself for those in the public who are watching and may not recognize him, even though he's been here many, many times. And I would like to announce that Mr. Lexi Painter, mother several years ago, had a very fine day, according to her, if I asked her. I think they call that his birthday. So happy birthday.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Alexi Pantry, Legislative Finance Division. Okay, so I'm going to start with some comparative modeling, so I'm going to switch to an Excel sheet for that. And then go into some other information on the cost of HB 78, and then go into some historical retention data that's a bit of a repeat from data we showed a few years ago, but the committee expressed interest in seeing that again. So Legislative Finance Division built a model of the various retirement tiers on the individual employee level, so you can compare in hypothetical scenarios what these systems would look like under varying assumptions. So we're looking at PERS Tier 3, which is the most recent defined contribution tier. We're not looking at Tiers 1 and 2. PERS Tier 4, which is the defined benefit tier, Tier 3. PERS Tier 4, which is the defined contribution tier. TERS, Teachers Retirement System, Tier 2, that's the last defined benefit tier, and then TERS, it says tiers twice, should be TERS Tier 3, which is the defined contribution tier, then HB 78, and it compares with and without the supplemental benefit system, which is SBS. We can also look at public safety and non-public safety members because they're slightly different calculations. We hid that for simplicity. They're pretty close, and we already have a lot of lines on the screen, so just for simplicity, we hid that by default. The goal of this modeling is to make it easier to understand how the policy choices in this bill affect retirees compared to the current system. So you heard a presentation yesterday. Our goal here was really to make sort of a more interactive model so you could compare different assumptions and see the kind of relative weight of those assumptions in a way. Because sometimes when you're looking at just a static model with somebody else's assumptions, it it's hard to see how important each one of those different variables is. One thing we did not model is different employee contributions. And each tier has different employee contributions, and sometimes within a tier there can be different employee contributions. We don't address that in the model for simplicity. And one thing to keep in mind, and the reason I wanted to highlight this, is that if employees chose to invest the difference in employee contributions, that could affect the results. So some of these tiers where there's a higher contribution or a lower contribution, if you assume that the employee takes that delta and invests it, you're going to get a different result than if they just spend that in their current consumption. And then when there's a higher contribution, we're not, modeling any of that impact. So one of the things I'd highlight is that the current DB tiers within tiers 1 through 3 have different contributions rate for different types of employees. So school district employees pay a higher contribution. Police and fire employees have 7.5, which is below what the TERS one is. And then all others pay 6.75%. And then if you compare that to tier 4, they're all at 8% for those different types of employees. So now that's a higher employee cost for some of those employees and a lower for some others. For tiers 1 and 2, the contribution was 8.65, and then TERS tier 3 is 8%, the same as PERS, the DC tier. And then HB 78 has variable employee contributions. It could be 8% up to 12% based on if there's underfunding that the Armed Board decides to increase employee contributions. Then the supplemental benefit system, SBS, there's an employee contribution of 6.13%, and so the state employees who are in PERS also receive SBS. Local employees who are in PERS, some are in SBS, some are in Social Security, which has a 6.2% contribution, some are in no supplemental system. And then TERS employees all have no supplementary system. And again, you could assume that if you wanted to, that all teachers choose to invest that 6.13% and they just don't get the state share for that, or you cannot assume that. We don't include that in our modeling, and that does materially affect some of these comparisons if you assume that investment. We just don't have any idea of employee behavior, so it's out. But I do want to flag that for the members of the committee to understand that that is a significant factor as what people would do with those contributions if they're not going to these systems. Okay, so slide 5, we're going to go over our baseline assumptions. A lot of these are based on a 2023 Division of Retirement Benefits presentation that looked at DC plan performance. So we're assuming 2.75% for the salary growth for an employee. Mostly we're looking at values relative to the employee's final salary, so the actual salary itself is not particularly important. I arbitrarily put in $50,000 for that as a non-variable. We've seen higher ones that, because of inflation for a 30 or 40 year career happens, either you have what seems like a really low starting salary or you have what seems like a really high final salary because of inflation over 30 years. It really doesn't matter for the modeling. The salary growth is more important. And then starting age, so what age you assume the employee starts state service, we're assuming age 25. That doesn't make a huge difference in the modeling because we're not modeling early retirement, we're just modeling normal retirement. Where that becomes important is in the existing defined benefit tiers, there's a provision for cost of living increases that kick in at a certain age or a certain number of years of retirement. And so when that happens will matter for what their retirement value is when you look at the life of their retirement. The career length, which is a pretty significant factor, and we're going to vary that in the modeling, the longer somebody's employed, the longer their defined contribution has to gain investment earnings, and also the higher their pension calculation is under those tiers. The investment scenarios is a very powerful assumption, which we can vary. The default here is 7%. That's, again, kind of arbitrary to be the default. You could use 7.25%, which is the percent that PERS or that the Armed Board is assuming. Again, we're going to vary that over the course of this presentation, and we have a lot of options, which I'll talk about when we go to the live model. The inflation rate default is 2.5%. That matters for in retirement when these cost of living adjustments happen. The higher your inflation rate, the lower, because under any of the pension systems that we're looking at, none of them have full inflation protection. So under the current tiers, it's half of inflation, and under HB 78, it starts with half inflation and can actually prorate below that. The higher your inflation, the faster that value is eroded. So if you have, 2.5% inflation, you see that value of the pension eroded relatively slowly. If you have 5% inflation, it's going to be faster. And then one of the most powerful assumptions when you're comparing a DB versus a DC system, again, defined benefit, defined contribution, there's a lot of acronyms, and I apologize for that to the members of the public and the committee probably too. We're using, by default, the same 5.89% that the Division of Retirement Benefits used in 2023. I actually, in preparing this model, I shopped around for annuities, and this is for the annuity conversion rate. So if you want to compare a defined contribution to a defined benefit, the easiest way to do that is to assume that you convert that defined contribution amount or the SBS amount into an annuity upon retirement, so you turn that into a steady cash flow. And I shopped around for annuities, and right now you can get them anywhere from 5% to the highest I found was 6.25%. You can get higher if you use kind of sketchier, lower rated companies that maybe have a higher risk of not being solvent for your entire lifetime. That's a powerful assumption and is one that's kind of difficult to model, and I'm just going to kind of lay out the difficulty for the committee. After the Great Recession, we saw an extended period of low interest rates that meant that annuities were paying a lower amount because they're more tied to the bond market. The last few years, we've seen the bond market have higher amounts where assuming anywhere from 5.5% to 6% has become pretty normal for an annuity, and that's pretty historically normal prior to the Great Recession, but we did have about a 15-year period where you couldn't get an annuity that high. So depending on what you think is reasonable going forward, the current amount of 5.5% to 6% being reasonable may be a reasonable assumption. You may assume that we might go back into a 2009 through 2022 period, and that will seem like a high assumption. That seems like kind of a modeler's choice. Again, the default we had was just to pick that amount, but the intent of the model is that you can pick your own assumptions and think what's reasonable, and we're going to go through those scenarios. That's one of the things that we'll test here. And that's a pretty powerful assumption when you're comparing a DB versus a DC system. You could also assume that people do something completely different in retirement. That we don't even model. We just really went with the annuity conversion. HB 78 also allows for post-retirement pension adjustments, or PRPAs, to be adjusted by the Retirement Management Board. By default, we're assuming that they're 100% funded, but in the model, you can do a partial amount or none. And then another factor here is whether the employee remains or the retiree remains an Alaska resident. In the existing defined benefit tiers, there is a provision where you can have a 10% cost of living adjustment after retirement over, I think it starts at age 65 or when you've been retired for 5 years. And then with HB 78, the PRPA can be prorated for non-Alaska residents. So that's going to affect those employees by default as well, or those retirees. Where you live in retirement is also a factor here. A lot of times these comparisons just stop at your first day of retirement and your first year. But a lot of these provisions in HB 78 that are cost containment provisions, you really don't see until you get to that age 65 or beyond. Because you see the impact of the partial PRPAs and you see the impact of not getting the 10% like the current tier. So the intent is to show all of these things by actually going out into retirement. So I'll pause for any questions on the assumptions before we go to the actual model.
Okay, go ahead and continue.
Okay. So let's see if I can do this successfully. All right, so this is the model itself. So I'd note that in these slides, we have some fixed, to get the zooming just right. We have some fixed scenarios in the slides. I'm going to go through those kind of one at a time, but I'm also going to be using the live model with the intent that by using the live model, the committee members can also ask for additional scenarios. So I may have to refer back and forth to make sure I'm going through in the right order. And I apologize for that. But so we're going to start with the baseline itself. So first I'll orient the committee to the model itself. So on the left, interestingly, the fonts are different than on my computer. So on the left, we have the calculations during the working career, which are nominal values. On the left, we have the inflation-adjusted salary replacement in retirement. And so the color coding here, course, does mostly matches my computer. So the purple tiers are the PERS tiers for that are defined benefit tiers. So PERS tier 3, and we have two lines which are not actually visible because they're identical to some others, and Excel chooses to pick one of them that you can see, but they're identical to the HB 78 calculation during the working career. And so the purple lines, which you cannot see right now, that are the same as the green, represent the PERS Tier 3 with and without SBS. And so I'll also say what the green lines are that are identical, which are HB 78 with SBS, which is this dark green line. That's also the same as PERS Tier 3 without SBS. And the light green is the PERS or the HB 78 without the SBS, and is also the same as the PERS public or non-public safety without SBS. The red line is, or I think it's supposed to be orange. The orange line here is PERS Tier 4 with SBS, and then the lighter orange is PERS Tier 4 without SBS. And then the blue is showing the TERS Tier 3 and PERS Tier 2, which I think is a little hard to see because it's a little covered by that green line. The colors are the same over on the right, but we're switching from actually the value of these amounts to the percentage of the inflation-adjusted salary replacement that this provides in retirement. So a few things I'll just kind of orient people to. So the highest numbers here that you see on both are for the PERS employees with Tier 3, so that's the defined contribution tier, who have the SBS. Without SBS, which is that supplemental system, they would have a significantly lower amount, which you see down here. So they go from at retirement with a 30-year career, having a greater than 100% salary replacement at retirement, down to something like 60% without the SBS with our default assumptions. For PERS Tier 4, the defined contribution, so they go with SBS from a retirement about 86% of salary replacement down to without SBS down to about 45%, 44.3% at, and that's, again, at retirement, salary replacement figure. For TERS, none of which have that SBS, the because TERS has that extra 2% employer contribution, those are a bit higher than those values, so you can see that that's 61% for TERS Tier 2 salary replacement in year one versus 51% for Tier 3 with our default assumptions. So I know that's a lot of items. The other thing I'll point out here are the assumptions where these lines diverge between HB 78 and PERS Tier 3 is when that, this is for an Alaska resident, when that 10% COLA for being an Alaska resident, cost of living adjustment kicks in. You can see that the Tier 3 amount goes above the HB 78 amount and remains above that. And you see a similar divergence for the non-SBS, and then you see that similar bump up in the PERS, the TERS tier as well. So I'll pause for questions. I know there's a lot of lines and numbers, so I apologize at how busy this is. Hopefully people can follow along. So this is our default scenario, comparing the various tiers.
Question?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. There's one line I'm not sure I understand, and I think it is the PERS Tier 4 with SBS. It appears to have on the right-hand chart, it appears to have a steeper slope than maybe any of the others. Can you help me understand why that would, its percentage of the income it replaces would decline at a faster rate than the others?
Through the chair, Senator Keel, the assumption was that people purchase a fixed amount annuity versus an annuity that has an inflation adjustment. If you can buy annuities that have an inflation adjustment as well, but you get a slightly lower rate. I wasn't sure what DRB assumed back in 2023 about what sort of annuity product you buy, and that's one of the problems with this annuity conversion is depending on what sort of annuity you assume people buy, what rate is reasonable changes. By default, I'm assuming it's not inflation-adjusted, but you can purchase an inflation-adjusted annuity, either a fixed amount, like I saw products that say you get a fixed 2% inflation adjustment, or ones that are variable. Variable costs, result in you have a lower annuity conversion rate. That gets into stuff that's just very difficult to model because there's so many assumptions. So I just assumed that it's not inflation-adjusted, and so you see that there's no – the other lines, there's some inflation adjustments because you assume there's a post-retirement pension adjustment of some sort. And then that, there's no adjustment. You just lose value in inflation. And it's not actually that rare for people to not have inflation-adjusted retirements because there's an assumption that your costs are going to go down in retirement. But it is obviously – looks like a pretty steep line when you see just no inflation adjustment at all.
Thank you.
Thank you. I guess, Mr. Painter, part of what's confusing about that, the other option would be to be invested for total return with a drawdown rate that allows it to actually grow and not only match inflation but with adequate performance to exceed inflation.
Through the chair, Senator Kaufman. Yeah, I actually started with modeling that, and then because to try to not make it completely arbitrary, I was trying to match what the retirement benefits had previously did, we switched that to be an annuity. If you assume something like a 4% draw that grows with inflation, for example, which is what a lot of retirement advisors would project you should do, then you'll see it's perfectly inflation adjusted, but it's a lower starting amount. So you'd see a flat line, but it would start at a lower point. So you can sort of assume that you're, because you wouldn't be drawing, 5.89% immediately, it'd be 4%, so it'd be a lower starting amount but a flat line. So we could add those comparisons if that's something the committee would like to see, of sort of different ways you could look at handling a defined contribution or SBS program that would deal with inflation, that would change that line. Happy to come back with that.
I for one would like to see a comparison to typical modern portfolio management with a reasonable risk profile shaping the portfolio. We just got done looking at what the permanent fund would do if we just reduced the draw rate down to something closer to what we're talking about for retirement. We see that it has growth and increase of returns on a per annum. So I think we should see something like that for the sake of making a good comparison.
There's a presentation coming from the Department of Revenue on the actual returns, which will be different than this returns here, actual returns on the portfolio.
And, Mr. Chairman, that's actually the first variable that we're going to start changing if the committee's ready to go to that. Okay, so I looked at a few different investment returns. And one comment I would have is that the actual investment return since that Division of Retirement Benefits was able to provide for the life of the DC plans, they've actually averaged nearly 10% for the total plan return. But that's because it doesn't – when you actually look at when the DC plan started, that was 2006. Their data starts in 2010. If you went back to 2010, you might see a lower amount. So one other way I looked at the long term was to take the actual long term average that PERS, the PERS plan itself received, which interestingly the mean investment return over from FY96 through 25 is exactly 8%. It works out to be exactly 8.00%. So if you look at if you switch to an 8% return, which happens to match PERS, the PERS long term amount as a fixed return, that results in an 8% return. And what you see there is that the defined contribution tiers now perform better than the defined benefit tiers. Well, not better because the SBS still increases, but you see a bigger difference between those systems with an SBS and without. So you still see a higher value for the defined benefit systems with SBS than the defined contribution systems with SBS, but you see a much bigger difference between the systems with and without SBS. Or, sorry, you see that the SBS systems perform a lot better than those that don't have the SBS because that SBS performance, which is based on the market, helps those systems quite a bit, whereas those pension performances don't really change. So you see a much bigger delta. And so you see with the 8% return, PERS Tier 4, PERS Tier 3, and HB 78 all start out over 100% salary replacement, but then the ones without SBS are still much – are still quite far below. And then TERS Tier 2 and TERS Tier 3 are nearly identical, which is – makes sense because that's how those plans were designed. When TERS Tier 3 was designed, it was designed with an 8.25% assumption to be equivalent actuarially to TERS Tier 2. And so when you put it to 8%, it's very similar. Those two tiers look almost identical, which was how they were planned at the beginning. So that's with a fixed return.
So on the SBS, yes. You're using the same return regardless of what we plug in, 7, 8, 9, whatever, pick your number. You're using the same return for SBS as you are for the defined contribution?
Mr. Chairman, yes.
Okay.
So another way to look at it would be to use the actual sequence of returns from FY96 through 25. And the interesting thing with this, the sequence of returns can go either way. This particular sequence of returns results in lower performance than the straight line because of the timing of the recessions. So in the actual sequence of returns, you see mostly positive numbers. The negative numbers are the dot-com bust of FY01 and 02. Those are going to be early in the person's career in this hypothetical because we're applying those early. Those don't hurt their balances very much. But the COVID recession and the 2008-2009 recession are later in the person's career in this hypothetical, and so they hurt the returns more. And those late career gains you can see do start to catch up. But this person hypothetically retires sort of, you know, near the end of a long sequence of positive returns. And so the actual sequence has lower a lower account balance than the fixed. If you kind of reorder those to be like optimal for employees, you could see the opposite, where the actual sequence of return results in higher values for the employees. This particular one is lower. I didn't run that scenario just for the sake of simplicity, but you know, if the actual sequence for somebody who entered the defined contribution in 2000, like in July 1st, 2006, they actually might have a positive return sequence because they would have the Great Recession when they had a low account value in 2008, 2009, like earlier in their career. And that's why you see the actual account performance of people tends to be higher than the assumptions in part because of they have a positive sequence of return. And that sequence of return risk is something that's very difficult to account for, but I think I'm just going to point it out as something that the particular sequence we have of the actual from 96 through 25 is negative for employees, but it can go both ways. Negative for employees in a DC contribution tier or in SBS. So that, in this particular case, drops you down from like 111% to 107%. Those strong years in the last few years do get a lot closer than, you know, if we had done this from like a little bit earlier sequence. I just used the last 30 years and, you know, by a nice coincidence, that happened to be exactly 8%. So then another sequence that we'll show is 6% fixed. So this is sort of a sequence that assumes low returns, lower than projected returns, for the defined contribution and SBS. And with this result, you see that none of the plans yield greater than 100% salary replacement, because that SBS plan and the DC plans return a lower amount. So with these, the non-SBS employees are down below 40% for PERS Tier 4 and at 44% for TERS Tier 3. With SBS, they're still kind of within that target rate for PERS, but not so much for TERS that doesn't have that added amount for the defined benefit tier, which it never is. It never gets to that amount. So having that lower return does mean that those defined contribution tiers would have a significantly lower amount. And this is sort of just an arbitrary 6%. Again, I'm not an investment forecaster, so I can't tell you what's reasonable, but this is just showing what a negative sequence looks like.
And then how do you account for a potential unfunded liability when you're dropped below the targeted rate?
So, Mr. Chairman, that on the individual employee level on HB 78 could be handled in a couple of ways. One would be to increase the employee contribution, which we're not modeling here, so you wouldn't see that. The other would be to reduce the post-retirement pension adjustment. And I don't remember if I sequenced them correctly, whether we could jump directly into that, but I do have a slide with that. But so one of the provisions in House Bill 78 is that if the return is lower or there – is an unfunded liability, so there's, you know, the plan is less than 90% funded, one of the options would be to reduce that post-pension retirement adjustment. So if you go to a 50% adjustment, you see that those HB 78 lines start to drop faster because you're getting basically a quarter of inflation, because you're getting half of inflation with the post-retirement pension adjustment anyway, and then you're getting down to a quarter when you half that, because you assume that that negative sequence means that you're underfunded and therefore the PERPA goes down. So that would result in the retiree seeing their, you know, retirement shrink in a real way, and you see that as these lines diverge on the graph.
But we've got the employee to worry about. We got the employer also. So is there financial impacts that the employer would face at 6% or 4% return or 0% return or what have you?
Mr. Chairman, that's correct. So with a defined benefit plan, you know, HB 78 has these cost-sharing mechanisms, but a lot of them are kind of up to the arm board about exactly how much that cost is shared and which lever they pull. So how much of that cost is actually borne by the state would depend on decisions by the arm board. The state could end up bearing part of that cost. It could be shifted entirely to employees, but the state could end up bearing a portion of that cost for sure.
Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess on the prior slides, we were talking about lower investment returns, and it generally looks like, for instance, the 6% scenario is pretty survivable. But we're assuming a 25-year-old start to the career, which I don't think that's our average, right? So When we look at these either lower investment returns, or you talked about the sequencing of returns having a material impact on what a person has when they retire, I think teachers on average start at 35, public employees start on average, I can't remember if it's 40 or 45, I'll get it wrong if I quote it to you, but with a later start, what does the difference look like for an employee riding out low returns or bad sequences?
Through the chair, Senator Keel, it's going to depend on whether they retire after 30 years or if that means they have a shorter career. So if you have somebody, like we can put this in the model, what happens if you have 35 and you retire at 65, so you still work 30 years? It still looks pretty similar. It's if you assume that somebody, really you have to go to like 40, you start at 40 and then you have a 20-year career because you're eligible for retirement. I'm not sure if you're eligible for full retirement at that or not, but let's say you just change that to a 20-year career. You're going to see much lower replacement levels because you only have a 20-year career and you don't have the time in the defined contribution to generate returns. You know, one of the things we can see, and actually, why don't we isolate that particular variable? I think that might be helpful. So let me go to the 20-year career versus 30 versus 40, and just look at the comparisons between the defined benefit tiers and the defined contribution tiers. So if you compare PERS Tier 4 with SBS to PERS Tier 3 with SBS, so in a 20-year career, the delta between the two with a 7% return is something like, you know, 15% difference, or really if you're looking at it as a percentage, it's a quarter of your retirement difference. If you go to a 30-year career, it's a larger, you know, raw difference, but as a percentage of your retirement, it's a smaller amount because there's more time for compounding. And then I'm not going to go to an artificially somebody works forever, but let's say you go to, So let's say you go to a 40-year career length, you're going to see that the relative performance of Tier 4 starts to really catch up because you get the benefit of more years of compounding. And so the relative difference between a defined benefit and defined contribution shrinks, and you get with, like, for TERS, if you assume a 40-year career, then the even at a 7% return, you see that Tier 2 and Tier 3 are identical. And if you did a higher investment return, you'd actually see where TERS Tier 3 could be more generous. So the longer your career, the better a defined contribution is going to look relative to a defined benefit, and vice versa. The shorter career, the defined benefit is going to look better. And that's just a factor that you can see in the model. And yeah, it's pretty plain in the model that that's a powerful assumption, is how long that career is and how long that those defined contribution plans can have to accrue. The longer the career, the better for the defined contribution.
But help me with the short, you know, there's a lot of people that work 5 years, 10 years, 15, 20. And the defined contribution, you take it with you and continue to compound it till you pull it out when you retire. Defined benefit, that's locked in. So help me with the shorter term.
Mr. Chairman, yes, it also depends on your sequence of your employment. So if you work for the state from age 25 to 30, you get your 5 years and then work for private employers for the rest of your career, the defined contribution is going to have all that time to compound, even though you're not still working the whole time, whereas that defined benefit is going to be kind of locked in, and so you're not going to get the value for that. If you work for the state the last 5 years of your career, you're not going to get any defined contribution compounding time, but that defined benefit is going to be your last 5 years, and it's going to be much higher. So another of these factors that, again, is hard to model but is a very real factor is that if you're early in your career and you're going to only work for the state for a short time, you would probably prefer a defined contribution. If you're late in your career when you start your state service and you're going to work for a state a short time, you'd probably prefer a defined benefit.
I think that's pretty accurate, actually. Generally speaking, across all plans.
So let's see. What are the other factors that I said I would model? Higher inflation. Okay. So if we go back to kind of our default assumptions for everything, except we switch from the 2.75. So, whoops, 25% inflation looks very bad. So if you go to a 4% inflation rate, you can see that generally everything gets steeper as the declines after retirement because none of the plans here are fully inflation protected. And so because even the pension plans don't have full inflation protection, they have partial inflation protection even at the best of times. So the result is those lines all slope down more steeply. And in reality, of course, we're not going to have even inflation every year. It's going to jump around. And if you have high inflation an early year before you're getting your post-retirement pension adjustment, so since that doesn't kick in till age 65, your retirement's going to look a lot worse because you didn't get any post-retirement pension adjustment for that. So let's say you retire at age 60. That first year, we have, you know, a 2022-like year where you have 8% inflation. You don't get any PERPA for that because that doesn't kick in until you're 65. And so your whole retirement is going to look a lot worse. And that's a factor, again, it's kind of hard to model unless you have variable inflation scenarios, and none of the plans really address that unless we had, as Senator Kaufman said, an assumption that you could have, you know, the inflation-adjusted annuity or an inflation-adjusted draw from a defined contribution or SBS plan, which we don't have currently modeled. So I'm mostly just pointing that out. We'd have to do additional scenarios to really see what an inflation-adjusted plan would look like in retirement. None of these plans, as currently modeled, really give full inflation protection necessarily, especially against inflation before that post-retirement pension adjustment kicks in. Okay, I think the other one I have on here as a slide, and I'm happy to model additional items, and then for the sake of the public, we can provide those fixed outputs on slides, would be a 4.5% annuity assumption. So this is assuming we're sort of more in the world that we lived in between 2009 and 2022, where annuities did not return as well as they are right now. And the result of that, and I'll just toggle back and forth so you can see this more clearly, is that those defined contribution and SBS plans perform worse than when you assume a higher annuity conversion rate. So the higher your annuity conversion rate, the better the defined contribution and SBS added plans look than those without. It's a pretty powerful assumption. You know, you can see that, like, for PERS Tier 4 with SBS, where you have both plans in the annuity, going from a 4.5% annuity to a 5.89% changes your salary adjust replacement from nearly 66% to 86%. So just that 1%, that one variable can make a huge difference in what your assumptions are. And so one of the things when you look at these kind of outside projections that are not interactive about comparing the tiers, what is their annuity rate that they're assuming? Because it makes a very large difference. And when the Division of Retirement and Benefits modeled these, one year they used 5.89%. I think another time they used 3.74%. When you're varying it that much, it makes a gigantic difference in the comparisons. And I would just encourage the committee to be cognizant of that, and when you're looking at modeling things, to try to be careful with that assumption that it doesn't, you're using something that's consistent or realistic for that assumption.
I think one thing to remember, though, that even like with our SBS, most people aren't going to annuitize it. They won't put it in annuity because you lose the account balance when you die, or you can have survivorship with your spouse. But they have a definite difference in the decision, and all of us sitting here at the table when we retire will face that with our SBS account. You can annuitize it, or you can just pull out 4.5%, 5%, 6% a year, keep the balance at the end. The same with the defined contribution plan. So assuming everybody's going to jump into an annuity and lose the account balance when you pass away, it's probably not likely going to turn out that way, because the vast majority of annuities don't get annuitized. Sounds kind of odd, but because most annuities, people put in after-tax money and they buy an annuity, but they don't annuitize it. They use it for compounding tax deferred and then pull out percentages. But you can annuitize them if you want, or part of it. They can take the defined contribution plan and annuitize half of the balance. There's lots of variables. Senator Keel.
Mr. Chairman, I don't know if anyone at the table would have the numbers. I saw them long enough ago, I don't remember to quote them. But when you looked at the Americans who had annuities by tax bracket, the higher you went, the more they were, and the lower tax brackets, functionally nobody had them. So I guess I wonder, as we look at what's a good retirement plan for public workers and teachers, ought we be modeling what Senate Finance Committee members and our level of financial sophistication might do versus what somebody spending 25 years in front of a classroom might do?
Well, I think that they have age-weighted account balance to pick from. They're not buying individual stocks. So, I mean, that's kind of that would be rather difficult to answer that question. And we're not using our own personal rates of return and our own SBS accounts here. Everybody sitting at this table knows they're substantially higher than 7%. So, but we'll have the department come in and talk about the rates of return, and maybe one of the questions we should ask the Department of Revenue, SBS has been around a long time. What's the historical rate if we even go past when we changed the retirement account in 2006? Let's take a look and back up those returns in SBS back further in time and take a look at them and look at the investment selection. I think that would be a good question for them.
And through the chair, Senator Keel, one thing I would add on that point is, depending on how your retirement is structured, if you have a pension, you're probably less likely to want an annuity with your SBS because you have that kind of guaranteed amount. And if you have a already, so maybe you draw what you need each year to pay your bills, and that's going to just vary. And you may not even do a fixed draw because, you know, I know some retirees who say, well, you know, I draw from my SBS when I need to, and that amount changes over time because I have my pension as well. But then somebody who has a defined contribution may choose to annuitize one, as Senator Stedman said, so you have some fixed income and then some that you can draw from in a more variable way. So it's very difficult to model the decisions of people. But I would say that kind of logically, if you have a pension, you probably wouldn't purchase an annuity on top of that because you wouldn't need two guaranteed sources of money. And so this assumption of using an annuity is really just a way to level an annuity, you know, a DC versus a DB system. But as Senator Stedman said, you know, in reality, people might draw differently. You may even see people have an increasing draw from their SBS so that they keep up with inflation even though their pension doesn't. So they start out with a 0% draw because they're already at 100% replacement, and then they ramp it up over time to keep level with inflation. There's all sorts of ways you can structure it, and it's just very hard when we're trying to model this to try to model individual employee and retirement and retiree behavior. And on kind of a similar point, when DRB did their modeling that this is somewhat based on, where they looked at actual employee balances in 2023, one of the things they noted at the time was that account balances were not as high as you would expect given the amount of time people had in the system and how many what their current salary was. And I think that really illustrates that something, you know, the committee talked a little bit about is that people's careers are often not linear. People often take time off. They move into higher and lower paying jobs depending on their life circumstances. And so you can't necessarily just assume somebody starts at age 25 and gets steady and increases. People are going to have much lumpier decisions like that than that. And we're just never going to be able to model that perfectly. We're always going to have these simplifying assumptions that we can debate on the committee, but it is notable that most of those decisions result in people having less money in their account because they're going to take time off from work rather than, you know, work a really high-paying job for 2 years and then go back down to a lower-paying job. You know, most people, they take time off and earn less.
So when those, let's remember, when those values were put on the table, it was at the bottom of the COVID financial markets, which have been substantially reversed in the last 3 years. So when the Department of Revenue comes in, the returns are going to look substantially different, just like all of our SBS accounts look a lot different than they did 3 years ago. So we got to, you know, we've got to remember, are you measuring it after a big bull run? Are you measuring it after a big sell-off or mediocre markets? But the numbers are going to look substantially different when revenue comes in and lays them on the table. And you can see it in our own account balances when you look at the returns the last 3 years.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I mean, I think that's an extremely important point, right? We do better to look across a wide variety of possible outcomes. And to steal Senator Kaufman's line, we probably ought to look at a typical modern portfolio management rather than a single data point, a single series of returns. If we're going to try and build a system for the entire future of the state of Alaska, we don't want to get locked in on exactly what the market was 3 years ago or exactly what the market is now. I think you've got that exactly right. Mm-hmm. But I very much appreciate Mr. Painter's observation. I'll just put my own gloss on him. It sounds like there's a certain element of economic behavior by individuals where they value some safety, right, where people who have a pension aren't going to buy an annuity, and people who don't, there is a higher likelihood they're going to annuitize for safety, for security of income. Not everybody, but again, we need to look across that spectrum of the people we want to have working for the state and the cities and the school districts. Thank you. Okay.
So we got about 25 minutes, I think. Do we want to go into the cost-shifting slides?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I'm happy to, if the members of the committee want, you know, other modeling that I didn't do here, I'm happy to either share the model or come back to the committee or just send those additional stereos to the committee.
I think it'd be informative for the committee members to have that done after we get the data from revenue on actual returns, and we can ask them for further historic returns than just 2006, because that's only 20 years. We can go back and try to get some, because the numbers are varying compared to what we've seen from different presenters and stuff. So we'll go on to page 14, and we'll talk about cost shifting.
All right, Mr. Chairman. So this is kind of similar to a little bit of the discussion in the committee yesterday, but slightly different, I suppose, focusing on the actuarial cost and kind of who pays for the cost, the added actuarial cost, because the fiscal cost to the state and the actuarial costs are not necessarily the same thing. For a few reasons. So the state as an employer pays the uncapped total PERS cost and then spreads that onto multiple fund sources. So when we passed SB 55 a number of years ago, that switched, the state used to be under the cap too. We switched that amount to be uncapped, and that resulted in a net savings to the state by shifting funds or by shifting costs to multiple fund sources. And we use a rule of thumb that half of the cost is UGF. This year that's 50.4%, but rule of thumb of 50% actually works pretty well. But if you look at a fiscal note and see that there's, you know, the state as an employer is going to pay $100 million, just hypothetically, it's not that high, then $50 million of that would be UGF. So it's not all unrestricted general funds. The amount that other employers pay is capped, and the state pays above the cap. And the Gallagher analysis assumes that there's a few effects of cost shifting here. One is that there's higher employer payrolls, and that has the result of spreading the existing unfunded liability over a larger base. So it reduces the amount above the cap because the existing unfunded liability from the existing tiers is then spread onto a larger base. And that partially offsets the actuarial cost of HB 78 because you're assuming that now the existing unfunded liability is spread across more payers. and then you are also shifting part of the state payments from the state on behalf to the state as an employer, which reduces UGF. So that increased payroll assumption has a result of decreasing the cost of the bill. And that gets into some questions about whether that's a realistic assumption. Actuarially, it may be a realistic assumption, but fiscally, is it a reasonable assumption? And so for TERS, the teacher retirement system, the school district employers, their payroll to some degree is capped by the amount of funding they get through the base student allocation. So for them to have a higher payroll, for school districts to have a higher payroll, would imply that either there's a higher base student allocation, increased local contributions, which many are currently capped, or the districts are choosing to spend on payroll and reducing spending on other categories, because the money has to come from somewhere. So I'm a bit skeptical of a projection that TERS payrolls are going to go up as a result of HB 78, because that implies other actions are happening. You know, the state is increasing school funding outside this as a result of this, which you can question it. On the other hand, if districts are seeing actual costs go up, the state may respond by saying, well, we would like to increase the base student allocation so that you don't have to cut other things. I mean, that could be a policy response. It's just implied in a way that I would just be careful to say that that is assuming other policy changes. For the state as an employer, it really gets down to whether you think the assumptions that HB 78, one of the impacts is going to be that it does improve retention, but that also we have existing costs in terms of premium pay and other things that part of the rationale for the bill, maybe you have all this premium pay that's going to go away. Well, that would have the result of reducing payroll. So you may not actually see a higher payroll. On the other hand, some of the things that we do because we have vacancies is contract costs. If those go away, you might see just a higher payroll and not necessarily see that reduction. But I would say that the assumption that just state payroll and local government payroll and a teacher and school district payroll are going to go up because you have better retention, I would question whether that's fiscally correct or not, because part of the premise of the benefit of the bill is that you see lower costs of other things that you pay on personal services. So I do question a bit of those cost savings that are actuarially built in, because they're assuming things that may not fiscally be true. And if you accept the other, you know, Dr. Giller-Jucci's presentation that the bill's going to pay for itself because you're going to have less premium pay, then the savings that you do see in the fiscal note might not show up, but you see this other savings. So I'm not saying like for or against the cost. I'm just trying to complicate, I suppose, which I apologize for complicating it, but complicate that analysis that some of the savings it doesn't show up in the fiscal note, and then some of the savings you do see in the fiscal note may not actually show up in reality. So things are maybe more complicated than they appear, unfortunately, for the committee. Another factor that I think is important is that the modeling that we are getting from the actuary only goes through FY39, which is the end of the time that we have the existing unfunded liability under the current actuarial assumptions. And so before, through FY39, you see the cost, the added actuarial cost of HB 78 is almost entirely borne by the state because we pay everything above the cap. But after FY39, in the absence of HB 78, you would see that employer costs should drop below that 22% cap. And so in FY40, absent HB 78, you would see a significant cost reduction to employers. HB 78 has higher actuarial costs, but that's still under the cap. And so you would still see a massive cost reduction for employers compared to what they pay in FY39. It would just be less of a cost reduction than they would see. And the state, the the additional cost as for the state as the next payer would be zero in FY40 because it'd all be under the cap and borne by employers, including the state as an employer. So one thing I would encourage the committee to do as you look at this bill is to ask for analysis that goes beyond FY39 because the who pays question changes materially in FY40, where the cost of added actuarial, the added actuarial costs of this bill shifts entirely to employers after that. And so having the analysis stop in FY39, I think, does not give you the full picture of the true impact of the bill, where that state cost is going to decrease significantly after FY39, assuming we do pay the unfunded liability. For TERS, it's a little, it's not quite material because the assumption is that the employers are still going to be over the cap because 12.56 happens to be closer to the actuarial amount. But for PERS, that does make a very large difference. And if you look at the fiscal notes, the cost of the bill is almost entirely in PERS. So it does make a pretty large impact in who pays. And I really encourage the committee to try to get analysis that goes beyond. 2 years ago, Gallagher, I think they were still not Gallagher, but Gallagher sent us Ledge Finance analysis that went through FY40, but we haven't seen newer versions of that. So if you are getting more analysis, that is a piece that I think would be useful for the committee to see. Okay. So going on to historical retention data, and this is perhaps a complement to the data presented by ICER on Monday. So this is based on data that we received in 2023. It hasn't been updated, but really the important years are the earlier years anyway. So I'm not sure that the added 3 years since then, or 3 years, yeah, would be that material. So they provided this data on employee retention from FY03 through 22. And the data shows whether employees hired in a given fiscal year are still employed by the same PERS employer in subsequent years. And it's broken out by employer in three categories: the state, other SBS employers, and other non-SBS employers. And they further break it down by TERS, PERS public safety and fire employees, and all other PERS employees. We're only going to cover PERS non-public police and fire, public safety and fire employees. The public safety and fire employees, there's a very small amount of those, so it's kind of difficult to trust that data. And then TERS, we didn't really have good enough data on that, and that was covered by ICER that covered those same amount employee group, and they had access to more granular data. Unfortunately, this data was really not at the employee level, so we couldn't run like statistical tests on significance and things like that. So we're just kind of eyeballing numbers. It's not like ICER that had data they could actually run statistical power tests. One limitation here is that if an employee leaves and comes back, they show up as a new employee. They don't show up as, you know, an existing employee. They didn't have that granular data. And so it may skew some comparisons of people coming in and out in some of the early years. So this first shows the retention rate by class year for PERS public, non-police and fire. I'm just going to say PERS employees for the state only. And so the class year, I mean, when did they enter state service? So the blue line is people who entered state service between FY03 and 06. Those are the last 4 years of the defined benefit system. And then we're comparing them to FY, in the red line, FY07 through 10, so people who entered state service then. Those are the first years of DC versus the next 4 years and then the most recent. And you can see that the most recent people who entered have the lowest retention, even below the other DC tiers, which may be a result of entering when the state was cutting budgets, so the kind of a last, you know, last in, first out sort of thing, perhaps. But there is a lower retention. And this compares by year. You can see that generally the trend for this is a pretty close numbers in the early years and then a bit of a difference opening up in the later years between the tiers, looking at just state employees only. And we're going to have different ways of looking at this. This is, I think, one of the harder ways to look at it visually and eyeball it. But my observation is that, you know, these lines all look fairly close, but there is a difference that opens up a little bit in some of the later years, and unfortunately the data just kind of stops before you could see if that continues beyond that.
Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Painter, I guess the question, though, is if, with the limitations on what you had available, isn't there likely to be a difference in where people go? So, you know, a defined benefit employee has an incentive if they leave the state to go work for Muni or for a school district, what have you, an employer where they can continue to earn their pension. But I think we saw 2 or 3 years ago on a different bill number, same concept, a great graph that showed the revenue max or the personal wealth maximizer is if you work 5 or 6 years in a defined contribution and leave the state to go earn a pension somewhere else. So what is the likelihood here that you've got a different behavior? You're retaining a public employee in public service in one system and they're heading out with the other.
Through the chair, Senator Keel, I think that's a great point that our data just doesn't cover here. And that would be where it would be great if, you know, I actually asked DRB if they could provide better data, and they said until they upgrade their system, it would be very difficult for them to provide better data than this. But if you could look at the employee level and actually track them, which it sounds like theoretically they have the data, but in practice couldn't actually extract from their system, I think you would be able to track that a lot better. And when we get to the non-state employee, which in a couple slides, one thing I would note is that the non-state employee, so these are other PERS employers like local governments, they show much worse retention. And I don't think that's necessarily because like people hate working for, you know, the city of wherever. I think a lot of that may be just that if your cities are smaller governments, you're more likely to move between the state and city if you start in the state in the city because it's just smaller. There's fewer opportunities, or move between city governments. You see lower retention across the board, and I don't think that's because they're worse places to work. I really think that's just because they're smaller employers. And if you could track them across employers, you might see different, you know, across PERS employers, say you might see different results, but we just don't have that data.
Mr. Chairman, we had the Office of Information Technology here the other day, and the retirement system, computer system, could have been the poster child for that presentation.
Okay. Go ahead and continue. Wait, we got a question from Senator Kaufman.
I just wonder if we have any comparative data on the private sector. So we talk about retention. How do we look in the public sector when compared to private sector?
Through the chair, Senator Kaufman, I'm trying to remember 3 years ago when I did this original presentation. I had looked at national data and tried to compare, but I don't remember the results of that. It's been too long for me to speak confidently
about that. You can get back to the committee on that.
Sure.
I think this issue is all across the country.
So, Mr. Chairman, this next slide is the same data, sort of, but in a different way to show it. So this is looking by year. So instead of looking like aggregating classes, we're looking at in how many people are still there in year 6 or year 11 who started in each of these years. And in the DB average, you see for at year 6, on average, 42.3% of people who started are still there, and in the DC systems, it's 40.2%. And some of that, why I wish we had better statistical power, is you see just a declining trend overall in the DC tiers that makes me wonder if there's an underlying trend that's unrelated to DBDC. We were not able to do the kind of test that ICER could, where they could look at whether the underlying trend existed still or not. In year 11, you can see they're a bit closer, and then it's more variable by year. So I'm not sure if we did a statistical test, I'm not sure if this difference that we see, the 0.9%, would have statistical significance or not. But again, the data we have, we can't do statistical tests of significance on these.
Okay.
So then we looked at non-state employers that are in Social Security or SBS and compared them to non-state employers who are not in supplemental systems. And so of the non-state employees, 2023 there were about 14,000. About half of them were in Social Security, a smaller amount in SBS, and then 5,000 in neither plan. So some of those people, you know, 5,000 to 14,000 have no supplemental plan at all. Some of them have a supplemental DC plan with SBS, and then some have a supplemental DB plan with Social Security. And so if you look at those non-SBS only, you do actually see a more significant difference than with the state that does have a supplementary plan. And that may relate to some of the things ICER talked about with plan generosity, that, you know, because the SBS plan results in a relatively generous plan, whether you're in DB or DC for PERS, you know, you may see a lesser effect than for the people who are not in either and have a relatively less generous plan, and you do see a larger difference here. And this is really that difference for that 5,000 people who are in no supplemental plan at all within PERS.
I think if I can make a comment on that, I think going back when we redid the pension plan back in 06 and 05, which is 05, it was unfortunate that we didn't require all employers that are going to participate in the state plan to either have their employees in Social Security or an equivalency, which would be supplemental benefit system or some other labor negotiated agreement. Because, as you mentioned, there's several thousand people around the state, and frankly, in my opinion, are getting the short end of the stick by their municipality. And that is not a state issue. That is a local issue. But it's an oversight, I think, on our part 20-some years ago that we didn't require that.
And, Mr. Chairman, this next slide shows, again, kind of the different view of this. So looking at year six for this employee class, and you can see, you know, a larger difference than you saw for the state employees who do have a supplemental system, where at year six you have, you know, about a 4% difference in how many people are still employed with that same employer, and then at year 11, it's a 2.4% difference. And so that's a significantly larger gap than you saw with the state, where, you know, one of the results of not having a supplemental system is perhaps lower retention and a larger difference between the DB and DC.
And if I could just make another brief comment, I think we all have this SBS accounts here. And if you're a state employee for 15, 20, 25 years, 30 years, say 25 years, you're looking at several hundred thousand dollars of difference, like $600,000 or $700,000 per employee. So when we show that they don't have Social Security or SBS, it is significant. It's not $100,000. In fact, there's many SBS accounts that are well over a million. So it's a issue that's not really reflected in the data sets that we just show that they don't have it. But it's big dollars.
So, Mr. Chairman, moving on to the next comparison. So this is looking at the non-police and fire DB. So we're comparing here. So this is all just DB employees, and we're comparing the state in blue, the non-state employers who are in SBS, and then the non-SBS employers. And you can see that just across the board, the non-SBS employers have worse retention, and the state has the best retention compared to these, which, again, the state's the biggest employer, so you'd kind of expect that it'd have better retention because people can move around more. But I think that difference between the non-SBS and SBS is notable. That just really shows that there is a difference in retention, likely driven by plan generosity, which, as ICER noted, and you can see that pretty clearly in this data. And again, this is DC only. You see a similar difference here. It's actually a little bit larger, where there's a delta between the SBS, the supplemental system employers, and the non-supplemental system employers. Again, it's a pretty significant difference. It's larger with the DC than it was with the DB. And that is the rest of my slides. Thank you to the committee, and I'm happy to get back with either additional scenarios or any other information.
Yeah, we'll probably have you come back with actual returns when we get them delivered from Department of Revenue, good or bad. We'll find out when they put them together and put them on the table what they are. And we got a little glimpse yesterday from retirement and benefits in that one chart, but there wasn't a lot of background. There was just numeric on a sheet of paper. So they'll have the opportunity to show us where they got those calculations, and I think Senator Keel had questions about that, the rate of return numbers. But we'll look at those. And then we can ask for an analysis stretching out, as you recommended, beyond the, 2039, pick up another 5 years or whatever it is. So that'll be helpful. So that concludes the meeting today. We do have an interest from the bill's sponsor to speak, but he may be better off to use his time when we're done and Department of Revenue has a chance so he can address the entire presentation. Does that sound reasonable?
No.
Okay. Come on up. We're about out of time, but you might want to save your rebuttal till you had the full data set in front of you, but that's up to you.
It's not so much a rebuttal, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Chuck Kopp, House District 10, facilitating this piece of legislation for the House Finance Committee. I want to thank the Senate Majority Leader who has made it possible for us to get this policy discussion to this point, and I want to thank the committee and the chairmen for allowing this discussion to occur and for hearing the presentations that you've heard. I want to acknowledge that the Department of Administration, the Equitable Institute, Dr. Brock Wilson, Legislative Finance, everybody has done some analytical work, and I think there's some serious analysis that went into these topics. But there are some items that these presentations did not show, and I just want to touch briefly on them, Mr. Chairman and committee members. The modeling assumptions, particularly with the Department of Administration, DRB, and Equitable, actually reinforced the strength of House Bill 78 rather than undermining it. And I just wanted to briefly review several key points that I think are very important. Both the Department and Equitable relied on investment return assumptions for individual defined contribution accounts of 10, 12, and almost 13%, and I think we would all agree that more recently we can understand that, but looking out over a 20 or 30 year horizon, that those are a bit optimistic, and even our investment managers, as we just heard from Legislative Finance, would not recommend that that to their own clients today. They're more looking at 6 to 8% during your working years and 4 to 6% during your retirement years. I think that's important. Our own ARM board models 7.25%, and they manage tens of billions of dollars in assets using these long-term return assumptions. So I think, are we going to ask this committee to believe that individual employees investing on their own will consistently outperform professional fund managers by 3 to 5 points every year over an entire career? I think it's just a fair question. We know that's really not how retirement systems perform in the real world. And I think very importantly, even the department's own footnotes in the Department of Retirement and Benefits slide acknowledge that the DC income does not include the cost of converting those balances into a guaranteed lifetime annuity with inflation protection, and that was adequately covered by the Legislative Finance Director. The Equitable presentation in particular, I think, deserves some clarification. They do place a heavy scoring emphasis on portability, meaning the ability for a short-term employee to take their contributions and the state's matching contributions and leave it with them. And that is, committee members, a legitimate policy preference to consider. But that is not the same thing as retirement security. So when you look at Equitable's numbers carefully, their analysis shows that higher lifetime benefit values under House Bill 78, when they looked at public safety officers, for medium-term and full-career public safety employees, those values were actually higher under House Bill 78, but they scored it lower because of their weighting methodology, which values portability. Again, it's a policy preference, but it doesn't show a weakness in House Bill 78. It just reflects a policy for portability over retirement security. I think another important clarification is that House Bill 78 is not the legacy pension. And I think all the presenters have kind of touched on that we're not going back to that system of the past. We've heard significantly that there's modern risk-sharing provisions, stabilizers, that the plan is designed to not fall below 90% because the employee contribution rates can increase significantly and the inflation proofing can be reduced or removed. Those risk-sharing mechanisms between employees and employers remove significant potential for unfunded liability. Our own state actuary has said that. It's a modern pension reform that's being used in states across the country that are doing well. But I think the most revealing element of the Department of Retirement Benefits presentation was to demonstrate potential risk. They had to model 3 consecutive years of 0% return. So even under the most pessimistic scenario, the projected status of the House Bill 78 subtrust performed admirably, with TERS still maintaining 89% funded and PERS at 88% funding after 3 years of 0% return, which our actuary has said, when directly asked by, I think, the chairman or Mr. Senator Keel, I forget, said it in his memory, he never could remember that happening in the market ever, as being a situation. So we know that's a risk that was an extreme scenario to get these plan to drop below 90% funding, and I think that's a great testament to the structural integrity of the plant, that it would take a beyond extraordinary event to dip this plan below 90% funding the way it's structured. But I think most significantly is that the largest cost driver of this is missing from the analysis, although Mr. Painter did touch on it, and that is the analysis that goes into the premium pay and the cost of errors and omissions that we're paying from employees now who aren't experienced because of high turnover. They're not being mentored by senior managers because those senior managers are vanishingly rare. We have employees that are incurring tens of millions of dollars of fines in state government. Our state auditor has just told us this. We have a failure to collect federal reimbursement receipts in the hundreds of millions of dollars. Our state auditor just shared that with us. And then we have the premium pay that is going out of sight, projected to be over $200 million this year. These numbers are orders of magnitude higher than the projected cost of this plan. And the cost exists because the current plan that we're in has failed to give us a competitive long-term career incentive for public service. And the state actuary has said that this plan would, in fact, flatten over time, help fill vacancies, and address some of these things. Oh, that's not in their bailiwick to quantify that, but we're doing everything we can to show clearly to the committee and the legislature and the public that those are numbers we can get our arms around. We know we have a $200 million cost today just in premium pay, not counting errors and omissions. We know local governments are capped at 22% of payroll for PERS, and we also know that the plan under House Bill 78 drops the PERS projected payroll to 10%, less than half of what we're paying today. So we have to look at both sides of the ledger. And I just want to briefly, Mr. Chairman, touch on the presentation from Dr. Brock Wilson. His opening slide showed something every school district in Alaska knows, which is we currently have the highest percentage of Alaska teacher vacancies in the nation. And the DEED, Department of Education Early Development, early education, just reported to the legislature that turnover in their most recent year was 28% a year, and their numbers are that's three times the national average. Three times the national average, and principal turnover is 35% a year. So I think that fact alone frames this entire discussion. This retirement policy is not just an abstract debate. It's directly connected to whether our communities can retain teachers, troopers, public employees, and Dr. Wilson's own research literature shows that increasing retirement benefits can reduce employee turnover by more than 30%. I think that's very telling in a state that's experiencing a dire workforce shortage.
So we're over time, so.
Yeah, I'm just wrapping it up, Mr. Chairman, thank you. Additionally, Dr. Wilson's study did not examine whether Alaska can recruit new teachers under the defined contribution plan, why teachers aren't choosing Alaska in the first place anymore, and why teachers are leaving after a few years. He looked at people who already decided to stay instead of why so few are choosing Alaska at all. It's the loss of these professionals that are the experienced members of our workforce. The governor's 2020 Teacher Recruitment and Retention Task Force interviewed over 4,000 educators, teachers, and principals, and they found in their top three that retirement benefits was their number one concern for educators, teachers, principals, and superintendents. It was their top one, a return to a defined benefit. So just right to the conclusion, Mr. Chairman, I think we can step back and look at the presentations the Department of Administration, the Equitable Institute, and Dr. Wilson, and the Legislative Finance Division. The underlying facts actually all point in the same direction. We know we have a workforce retention crisis. The retirement structure is one of the most powerful tools we can use to address this. So the real policy question is not whether retirements involve risk. Every retirement system involves risk. The real question is how that risk is managed, and whether Alaska's retirement system supports the recruitment and retention of the public workforce that our communities depend on. We believe this represents a carefully managed and designed modernization of our retirement system with professionally pooled investment, modern risk-sharing safeguards, predictable retirement security for our public servants, and a structure designed to stabilize our workforce. And when all those work together, House Bill 78 is not only fiscally responsible, it's necessary for our long-term workforce stability and public service. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, thank you. That concludes the meeting today. Our next meeting will be Monday, March 16th, 9 a.m. We're going to hear the spring revenue forecast from the Department of Revenue, and we'll have a little insight of what our next year's budget will look like, and we hope for good numbers, but not ridiculous numbers. We are adjourned at 3:08 p.m. We are adjourned.